Have you ever wondered how a song is made? How it starts? What happens during the recording process? How does an idea become that beautiful 3-minute thing you hear on the radio? My name is Emmeline, and in Journey of a Song, I take you on a tour of a musician's creative process, from the very first notes to the final, fully produced progression. As a singer-songwriter and an independent recording artist, I am intimately familiar with the magic of music creation, but I also know that each song has its own sacred story. Each week, I'll be talking to a different songwriter as they pull back the curtain on a favorite composition, beginning with the acoustic version of the song and ending with the final recorded product. In between, you'll hear a conversation about the inspiration behind the song, the decisions made in the recording booth, and the many ways in which music reflects and informs our emotions and our lives. This week, my guest is the thoughtful, talented Christine Hand. An English professor by day, Christine teaches songwriting at Dallas Baptist University. Her most recent album, The Book of the World, features keen insights wrapped in catchy melodies and delves deeply into what it means to be human. She's here today to talk about one of the most resonant tracks from The Book of the World, Nothing Else Matters. Welcome back to Journey of a Song. I'm your host, Emmeline, and I'm so excited for today's episode because we have with us the lovely Christine Hand. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Emmeline. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. I'm so excited. We've been trying to get you on the show for a while, so I'm glad that it finally worked out. Both of us are busy in our day jobs and busy in our lives, and I'm glad that we finally get to connect.
Me too.
And we are here to discuss your beautiful song, Nothing Else Matters. And we're going to let the listeners hear the acoustic version of that right now.
All right, cool.
I could write 1,000 songs, shimmering with angel tongues, golden voices all night long, and only have clatter. But if I don't have love, what does it matter? Nothing else matters. I could plan a perfect daughter, sister, mother, wife, spend my years in daily strife, climbing the ladder. But if I don't have love, what does it matter? Nothing else matters at all. When the last silence falls, and the bright trumpet calls happily after. I could fathom mystery, know the mind of deity, view the glass with clarity, see it all shatter. 'Cause if I don't have love, what does it matter?
Beautiful. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you. That was fun.
We talked a little bit offline about how this is one of your favorites, but you don't often get the chance to talk about it. So I'm really excited to dive deep.
Yeah. Thank you. Me too.
For sure. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of writing this one? Because you mentioned that you wrote the verses out of order.
Yeah. So I wrote this. So let me go back to where I was when I wrote this. I wrote this in the car. So what was happening is I had just got done teaching a class. It was my songwriting class, and I want to say it might have been my first semester to teach that class, or maybe the second time I taught it, but I was still relatively new to the process. So I teach this introduction to songwriting class at DBU where I teach. And the thing about teaching that class is it's constantly inspiring and intimidating at the same time. So it's inspiring because these students are so good. They're so good. Every semester I walk away just like, amazed. Like, they're young and they're talented and they're brilliant and their songs are so great, and we just get to spend this time, you know, playing music, talking about the writing process, talking about nerdy things like rhyme schemes and metaphors, and just sort of basking in the glow of creativity. And it's so great. So I will often, after leaving that class, go, man, this is it. This is why I teach. This is what I want to do. This feels so good. I'm so inspired. So I have that. But the other side of it is it's intimidating because they're like 19 years old and they're amazing. And so I'm walking out of class going, oh, they've figured it out. They're all so good. And I've figured nothing out. I'm the worst. I'm, you know, and so this was probably the spring of 2015. I was like, I'm in my early to mid 30s and they're all so much better than I was when I was their age. So I'm walking away feeling these like double emotions. Like, on the one hand, I'm super inspired and I'm riding this high of creativity. And on the other hand, I'm starting to feel a little down about my life. Like, what am I doing with my life? I should just quit all of this and write all the songs. I should just be writing a whole lot of songs. And this spawned the thought, I could write 1,000 songs. And that's the first line. So it's interesting how kind of coming out of that feeling of both feeling inspired, but also feeling really intimidated and kind of like that worry of like, what am I doing with my life? That I had this thought, you know, I could write 1,000 songs, but it might not matter. Like, it might not matter, because what does matter in life? And the thought that came to me is the thought that often does, that what ends up mattering at the end of the day and at the end of our jobs and at the end of our lives is how much love we put into it and how much love we put into the world, how much love we put into our work. And that was the inspiring thought. So I was driving away from class and had this line pop into my head. So then it grew from there.
That's,
I feel
awesome.
Like I should give you a chance to talk, even though I have more to say.
No, say more things. If you have more to say, please share.
Okay. So it started with that line. It grew from there. So what happened is I had this thought I could write 1,000 songs. And then I sort of built on that. And as I remember it, I think because I had the idea of, oh, well, only love is what matters, it did make me think about 1 Corinthians 13, which a lot of people probably know this passage because it's a passage all about love. So it gets read at a lot of weddings. So if you go to a wedding, like any random wedding, and there's a scripture reading, the chances are really high it's going to be 1 Corinthians 13, because you have this long passage that's like, oh, love is patient, love is kind, love never fails. In the end, these three things remain: faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. So it's just this like beautiful hymn to love. It tells you all about what love is, and it proclaims that love is just the most important thing, and it's the thing that's going to outlast all the other things. So the way that passage starts is, if I speak in tongues of men or angels, but I have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. So the thing that I was thinking about was like, gosh, it wouldn't matter if I wrote 1 billion songs and they were the best songs anyone had ever heard. If I'm not doing it with love in my heart, and if I'm not living a life of love, it really doesn't matter how great those songs are. So since I kind of had that context in the back of my head, and I'm not sure all of this was conscious because I was just driving and mulling thoughts through, as one does. And so this was just kind of rolling around in the back of my brain. So this first verse kind of came out. I could write 1,000 songs, shimmering with angel tongues, golden voices all night long, and only have clatter. If I don't have love, what does it matter? Mm-hmm. So then I wanted to keep going. And what I discovered was that I had written myself into an interesting hole of having to follow a really particular rhyme scheme, because I knew that I wanted to, at that point, end the verses with that same line, if I don't have love, what does it matter? Which meant that I would always have to have that next to last line rhyming with matter. And I don't know if you've ever tried to rhyme this word, but it's actually kind of a strange word to rhyme. So the next thing that I think I did is I'm like sitting in traffic and I'm going through my brain like, okay, what are all the words that could possibly rhyme with matter? So it's like, we got clatter. That's a pretty good one. I was pretty proud of that one when it came out. I was like, yeah, clatter and matter is a great rhyme, you know? And then it just got really difficult. So I'm thinking of all the weird words like smatter and splatter and like mad hatter and you know, like going through them in my head, and you kind of have to brainstorm some of the words that won't work before you'll find the words that will work. And I started to have kind of a running list in my head, and when I finally got to the word ladder, which appears in the second verse, I was really happy. I'm like, oh, that's not so. With rhymes, you have exact rhymes, which you want them to match exactly in the sound. And, you know, in English, in American English, we say clatter with that kind of D sound and matter with that kind of D sound. It's like a real soft T. And so ladder ends up sounding the same, but there's a tiny, tiny little difference. They're not the exact same consonants. I was being real picky, and when I realized, you know what, they sound the same. I felt happy about that. So those are really close. Those are really, really close in sound. Sometimes I can be really picky about rhyme because I really want the sounds to match as much as they can. I'm a real sucker for closure and the kind of closure that rhyme can give you. So anyway, this led me finally to this second verse. And I knew that I wanted to build on this idea from the first verse, that the only thing that matters at the end of your life is love. So the second verse builds on that with kind of a depiction of a modern woman's life. I could plan a perfect life, daughter, sister, mother, wife, spend my years in daily strife climbing the ladder. Mm-hmm. But if I don't have love, what does it matter? And so I think I probably, at that point, skipped ahead to what's the last verse of these A sections, which we can talk about that at another time, the different sections of the song. But I, following that same pattern, I got to that third verse. And this is something that actually comes from 1 Corinthians 13. So the verse goes, I could fathom mystery, know the mind of deity, view the glass with clarity, and see it all shatter. If I don't have love, what does it matter? Well, that's also from 1 Corinthians 13. It talks about, it's this moment where it's kind of talking about how we don't see things in our present time the way we wish we would. So it's like we're looking in a glass that's dark, or it's foggy, it's cloudy. But one day we'll see face to face. So the idea is that at the end of time, everything that is sort of cloudy and foggy to us that we don't understand, we'll see it. We'll see face to face. And the thing that remains at the end is still love. So what was interesting for me in getting wrapped up in that passage and going through those ideas was that it stopped just being a song about the love that I put into my work or the love that I put into my life. And it suddenly became a song about the end of the world. And that's where the rest of the writing went when I finally got home and put pen to paper to write the other parts of it.
I love that you I love that you highlight that journey. It seems to sort of parallel the thinking that you described in the beginning, where you were talking about going from being super inspired by your students to thinking, oh my God, what have I put out that matters at all? I think so often as artists, we suffer from this imposter syndrome. Like, we think we've made something good, and then we look back and we're like, oh, but is it really good? Maybe it's not really good. Maybe I don't. And it very quickly spirals from maybe it's not really good to maybe I know nothing and I should just quit.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you went through a similar spiral in this song, where it starts with, you know, this notion of I could write 1,000 songs to, like, the world could end.
Yeah.
And so often in our brains, it does, right? Like, we go from I know things as teachers to I think I know things to maybe the students know more things to I don't know anything. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. And so some of that is the, you know, just like normal insecurities or whatever. Some of it is just wanting to make a difference with your life and hoping you can be good at that. But part of it is a healthy unknowing. And I think that that's where the song goes next, that at that point in my life, I mean, and I would say, so I'm 38 and I guess I was probably 33 when I, it's been that long since I wrote, 32 or 33 when I wrote this. And so for me, my 30s have been a time of kind of unraveling of a lot of things that I thought I was certain about, a lot of things that I thought I knew for sure when I was younger. And over the last decade, many of those things have sort of unraveled. I've become less and less certain about things that I used to think I knew. And I think that there's a certain amount of healthy unknowing, or a healthy embrace of mystery, because there are just some things that we're not going to know, we're not going to ever fully understand in our lives. And in the face of that unraveling, yeah, I was clinging to what can I know for sure. And to me, that thing is love. It's doing things in a loving way. It's living your life toward others in a loving way. So that really mattered to me a lot. But also when you're thinking about the end of the world, like, I mean, I don't like dwell on the end of the world all the time, but those listeners at home who don't know me yet, one of the fun facts about me is that I wrote a doctoral dissertation on Bob Dylan and all his songs about the end of the world. So Bob Dylan, he talks about apocalypse all the time. And I find that the way Dylan discusses apocalypse also is kind of like this embrace of uncertainty, coupled with like crazy scenes of destruction and end of days. But it's always like everything is wrapped in a mystery. So, you know, probably that was on my brain too. I had wrapped up that doctorate just a couple of years before I wrote this. So I imagine that all of that was kind of floating around up there in the mental soup when I got to the next part, when I came home and started to write the next part.
Yeah, you said something earlier that I wanted to highlight in the mess of all of that, which is that one of the things that you don't always know as a songwriter is whether something is conscious or subconscious. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you are sort of steeped in the juices of different discussions that you have in class or topics of dissertation or research that we do as academics, those things are constantly floating around in your head. And what they provide is fodder for songs, because we're constantly making those connections.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got home. I wrote down what I had as quickly as possible. And what I had were these three verses. And they're verses that end in this like hook. If I don't have love, what does it matter? And so I knew because of that, that I probably was not writing something that was going to have a verses and a chorus. Because typically if you're going to have a chorus, then your hook goes in your chorus, but I had put it in my verses. So I knew that this was going to have to be in the, some people call it a verse refrain form. Some people just call it an AABA form. I think it's less popular among songwriters these days, but it was hugely popular with, like, Gershwin and Cole Porter. So all of those classic Tin Pan Alley era songwriters, they would use this formula, and then the Beatles used it a ton. The Beatles love this. And there are some more. I mean, like Gravity by John Mayer is a good example of one. So this is just me getting nerdy about song form types, but I'm surprised by how many people don't know what this type is. And sometimes they'll get to a B section in a song like this and they won't really know what to call it. Do you call it the chorus? What is it? I don't know. I think of it as the B section. It kind of functions like a bridge a little bit, but it's not exactly a chorus, because what feels more like a refrain is that thing that happens in the verse. And sometimes it'll come at the start of a verse, like Yesterday by the Beatles is a good example. Or sometimes it'll come at the end of the verse, like Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by Carole King is a good example. So anyway, so that's what I realized I was writing when I sat down. So I knew I was going to have a B section. So I jumped into it, and I guess I was just really enjoying this thing where I would do an A rhyme, and then that that next rhyme that rhymes with matter. I don't know what was going on, but I just was really into it. So I went with that same kind of pattern. So what ended up happening is I have this long-running rhyme scheme that cuts across the entire poem, where we're rhyming that matter. So we've got clatter, matter, ladder, and then I kind of cheat with after and laughter, but they're close, and shatter and scatter and tattered. So I ended up having that particular rhyme scheme run through a through line through the entire song. So that ended up being kind of a fun puzzle to work out and to play with. And because I found myself dealing with these like mysterious thoughts about the end of the world on the one hand, and this kind of difficult rhyme scheme, or it felt difficult to me because I had never tried one like it before, I ended up letting that rhyme scheme kind of take over and lead me to some lyric places that I might not have gone to if I was just trying to be, I don't know, correct. Or if I was trying to make sure I said something that everyone could agree with. Instead, I just sort of let the form show me where to go. And it went in a totally different direction than I imagined. So these B sections, they pick up where the verses left off, or where the verses leave off. So I say, nothing else matters at all. When the last silence falls and the bright trumpet calls happily after, nothing else matters to learn when the final fires burn and every tear has turned into laughter. So these are just sort of kind of random end of the world images. When the bright trumpet calls, recalls the sound of the last trumpet that you can read about in Revelation, or final fires. And there's a lot of discussion of fire, and you're going to get a lot of different opinions about what fire means at the end of the world. I left it purposely vague, but someday there's going to be a final one, we hope, like the end of the fires. Because I wanted to bring the focus on the good part. Every tear has turned into laughter. And I don't think I wrote, like, those two sections I didn't originally put together. I think I originally had it with the, like, split in two and matching with the other B section. So they were kind of in different order. But my favorite part of this verse is the line when the last silence falls, because my husband and I were on this Doctor Who kick. So we'd been watching a lot of Doctor Who. And there's this episode where there's like I don't know what to call it, like a prophet on Doctor Who, and they keep saying, silence will fall when the question is asked. And it's like a this line that goes through the whole episode. And who knows why, but that's what made it into the song. I wanted when the last silence falls. So I didn't really mean anything by it. I liked the way it sounded. It reminded me of Doctor Who. It didn't have a lot of meaning. And then much, much later, I presented this to my, I have a writer's group, and I presented it to them, and they were like, oh yeah, that also is in the Bible. There's a place where like silence falls over everyone, and then the trumpet sounds, and I was like, okay, cool. I was thinking about Doctor Who.
You're like totally intentional. Nailed all of my biblical references.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because what I was going to call out too was your rhyme in threes, which is sort of Trinitarian, which is extraordinarily biblical.
Yeah, I didn't do that on purpose, but probably those three patterns are deep in me from being raised with three-point sermons and all those students writing their three-point thesis statements. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes, our three-point body paragraphs, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I think that that to me was sort of unique in a very illustrative way, because, you know, we, like, ideally the most perfect relationship of love we have is that between us and God.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're, you know, looking at 1 Corinthians and you're talking about biblical love. And so this idea of like this perfect trinity, if you will, of rhymes being linked with something that, to your point, is a little awkward sometimes, especially to rhyme, it sounds like, is very like God and human.
Yeah. Well, and now that you're bringing it up, I mean, some people talk about the Trinity as just like this love relationship. Like, we see, like, we're not, listen, everybody, we're not going to solve the mysteries of the Trinity today on this podcast. That's not what we're here for. But some people talk about it as if it is this never-ending relationship of love between God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit that just kind of goes on forever. So, you know, it works.
Well, and
I totally did it on purpose.
Exactly. There you go. I was like, that's a line you steal from students.
Yeah.
Did you mean to? Yes. I always meant to do that.
Yeah.
No, that was, and you do, you say love will still be love three times at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Which felt very Trinitarian.
Yeah.
And there's my half a theology degree coming out.
All right. Learning so many things. It's fun.
I knew this would be delightfully nerdy. I'm so excited that we've already gone.
It really is. Then the only lyric part I haven't talked about is the very last part. So the very last part goes, nothing else matters to say when December turns to May. This is a line that I straight up stole from this hymn. I feel like the words are very, very old, but I sang a version of this in choir. A version by John Rutter, and it's called What Sweeter Music, and it's a Christmas song, and it's just kind of, the gist of the song is you're walking around at Christmas time and you are filled with, you know, the joy of Christmas, and you say, what sweeter music can we bring than a carol for to sing the birth of this our heavenly King? And it rejoices in the future time when, you know, even though we're sitting here at Christmas time and it's December and we're cold, someday God will make December turn to May. So they in the song, you're singing to the baby Jesus and he makes December turn to May. So that little line was just lifted, just completely stolen from that. The blazing realm of day, I mean, the kingdom of daytime, there's... And that God himself will be their light. So darkness will scatter. And here's where things got... here's where things went to an interesting place that I didn't think they would. So nothing else matters to do will still be me and you, even if our precious truths are torn and tattered. Love will still be love, and nothing else matters. I think maybe younger me, like me in my 20s, would have been afraid to say something like, even if our precious truths are torn and tattered, love is what matters. Like, I think I would have been afraid to say that. But when I talk about the kind of unraveling of a lot of things I thought that I had previously believed, it was really important for me to know that even if I can't be certain about everything I think I know or everything I hope is true or whatever, that the thing that we can hold on to at the end is still love. And that's still the thing that keeps me believing. Even when parts of my faith have changed and parts of what I believe have changed, I'm never going to stop believing that God is love and that love is the end goal here. Love is the end goal of all of this. And I mean, I really believe that with all my heart. So it was important for me to also bring it down to the level of perhaps a relationship with another person will still be me and you. So it can be personal love. Our personal love will last, but it can also be like God's love that will last. And these are the things that stay. And that line, love will still be love, this was really another way of me saying that God will still be God, that no matter what you think is gonna, like, even if your concept of God changes, or if even if like what I think is true turns out to not be true, the thing that is true will still be. If I don't know if that makes any sense. Man, we're getting so deep tonight.
I'm proud of us. I'm proud. No, but I love that you talk about that, because I think that that is one of the things. I think that when we're little, and we talk about this some on the podcast, but I think that when we're little, right, we have this idea in our heads that adults have everything figured out. And part of the aspiration of adulthood is I'm going to get to be an adult and then I'll have it all figured out. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for some people it happens in their early 20s, for some people it happens in their late 20s, for some people it happens in their 30s. But you do reach a point where you look around at your fellow adults and you're like, nobody knows what they're doing. Like, it's all a big lie. Like, nobody ever knew what they were doing. They were just really good at faking it. Why did nobody tell me about this? And I think you're right. You know, our concept of life changes. Our concept of purpose changes. Our concept of, you know, our place in the world changes. And that can be a scary thing with which to grapple when you fall into the traps of the certainty of rightness.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this song, I want to talk a little bit about my background here. I didn't mean to write this song that was about 1 Corinthians 13. I didn't write it in such a way that it comes across as only a Christian song, because that really wasn't my goal. And I didn't even think that we'd necessarily be talking about the Bible this much today. So the whole thing was kind of this surprise to me. I think the reason it works is because I wasn't approaching it from a place of certainty. I was approaching it from a place of exploration. And that's just the place where we have to be. So one of the things you have to know about me is that when I was a little kid, probably the first time I understood what a singer-songwriter was when I was about 7 years old, and somehow I ended up with a cassette tape of the album Lead Me On by Amy Grant. And I can vividly remember sitting in my bedroom listening to that cassette, and I unfolded the long multi-panel insert that was inside this, you know, that was inside cassettes back then, and I poured over every lyric. And I remember listening and paying attention to every lyric, and I believe that they had actually labeled the song parts in that lyric insert. So I was sitting there learning, like, this is a verse, this is a chorus, this is how a song works. And that's my earliest memory of making those connections. And from then on, what I wanted was to be Amy Grant. At some point, I also wanted to be Mariah Carey and then maybe Jewel a little bit. Mm-hmm. But Amy Grant was the first one. So the first vision I had for myself as a singer, songwriter, was as a Christian musician. Mm-hmm. And as I changed and as the music industry changed and really the market for what it might mean to write Christian music, that all changed dramatically from the time I was a kid listening to Amy Grant till the time I was an adult trying to make music. So by the time I was writing this song, Nothing Else Matters, I was just trying to write for a general audience, but also be myself and express the things that are important to me. I certainly wasn't trying to write something that I would mark it as Christian music. So this conversation has been really interesting to me because I'm not sure even I understood the just kind of the depths of the theological exploration that were happening here. Mm. It's apparent in the song, and I feel it when I sing the song, but it wasn't like a goal of mine to try to write a sermon. I was just trying to explore some ideas.
Well, and I love that you talk about that, because I think that there's this myth sometimes that bringing any sort of religious or faith-based element into something is preaching.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, you know, it becomes a life philosophy. And it's right. not necessarily a life philosophy into which you have to shove everyone else or that you have to demand other people follow. It's just something that guides you, something that becomes the light that, you know, shows your feet where the next step is. And
yeah.
what I hear in this is sort of that comfort that we give ourselves as adults that says, you know what, you don't have to know everything. In fact, most of us don't know everything, aren't going to know everything. But what we can know is that we want the best for the people around us, and we want to do our best to provide that for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's sort of the mentality that I have as a teacher when I step into a classroom, and I think something that we share is this idea that on any given day, you could be absolutely the expert in the room. You could also be the person who knows the least about the thing that everybody starts talking mm-hmm. about. Man, the day that all of my students started asking me questions about TikTok was a hard day to be a teacher. I was like,
honestly,
what has the world become? I don't know anything anymore. But
my favorite thing to do actually is to, a lot of times I'll teach, so when I teach freshman composition, that first level of writing, I really like to do a pop culture thing, because what ends up happening is they teach me, that sounds really cliche, but they teach me so much. They teach me slang that I've never heard of. I've learned a lot about TikTok that way. I mean, and it's great because then they get to be the experts. So it works out.
No, I learned the whole saga of Olivia Rodrigo and Joshua Bassett and Sabrina Carpenter and like how Olivia Rodrigo's album happened because we were talking about narrative arc and, you know, stepping into a more dramatic character and
That's
writing
brilliant.
From a place of empathy. And it was great. Like they teach me so much in that respect. But it's, you know, I think that the way I comfort myself from imposter syndrome, and it sounds like something that you do the same,
mm-hmm.
is to say, you know what, I lead with love. Like I walk into the classroom and I try and
yes.
give something valuable. And maybe that's my knowledge, but maybe it's not. Like maybe what they need that day is to have one of us listen to them talk about something that matters to them. And maybe that's the most valuable thing I can give that day.
That's
and
absolutely
that is
right.
just as valuable as me walking in and spouting a bunch of stuff that I, you know, wrote in a thesis or a dissertation eons ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing when it comes to just making art, when it comes to writing songs, I mean, I am a big believer that when you write something, you should try to put it out in the world. I guess I should have more patience for this, but I don't have a ton of patience when people say, oh, I've written all these things, but I've done nothing with them. And maybe that's just me being an overachiever. But at the same time, I have to realize that that work of art is valuable just because you made it and just because you made it with love. And I have plenty of songs that have never seen the light of day. And I'm thankful that I've been able to bring many of them to the world, but I also have to realize that those other things that don't see the light of day, they're not worthless. They're valuable because of the love that has been poured into them and because of what they taught me through the process of writing them.
I was going to say, we don't always realize when we put words to paper or when we put, you know, voice to a song, what we're working through in our own heads or what kind of fruit
mm-hmm.
that bears.
Mm-hmm.
Like what yeah. songs lead to other songs. Those are paths
yeah.
that we can't always trace. We had a writer named Rachel Warecki on the Journey of an Artist podcast last week, and she was talking about how she puts words down on paper every day. And she's like, even if it's just a sentence, even if it's a terrible sentence,
mm-hmm.
she's like, and I knew that I was building a habit. I had no idea that it would lead to like a draft and a half of a novel.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's little things like that. She's like, and not every sentence that I put down wound up in the draft.
Right. That's the song of adulthood to me, has been learning, or the secret of adulthood, I don't know. It's learning how those little things absolutely add up. Mm-hmm. It's a lesson I have to learn and relearn every day. It's a lesson that I'm constantly teaching my students. Like, literally just set a timer and write for 10 minutes, because then you'll have more than nothing. And that's better than nothing, right? And that's been a huge, huge thing for me. And like, I know that I wouldn't have this song if I hadn't had to go through some of those painful experiences in grad school. Because when you're writing a dissertation, you have no choice but to just kind of slog along and put words on paper. What I learned is that writing always begets writing. And that if you, I mean, it's almost like just rolling a boulder down the hill. Like, you have to start the writing if you actually want to tip that boulder and get it to roll, which sounds very obvious, but a lot of us think we can just get struck with inspiration without starting the writing process, and that's not how it works. So I do know that this song probably wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had a lot of practice of letting myself write some really imperfect things, because it made me feel more comfortable with putting a line in, like, when the last silence falls, oh, haha, I don't know what that means, but I thought of it from Doctor Who, or even if our precious truths are torn and tattered. I don't know, someone might think a wrong thing about me. They might think that, I don't know, that they might disagree with me if I write that. I had had some practice at that point of actually putting some things on the page that felt a little scary and a little uncertain, so that when I needed to put it in a song, I could.
Yeah, two things that you mentioned in that I really want to highlight for our listeners. One being that, like, not everything you write has to be perfect.
Right.
And so often as artists, we hold ourselves to the impossible standard of making everything perfect. And that I think, is the hardest lesson of writing, is that not every word that you write is going to be a good word. And that you have to write some crappy words to get to the good words. When I was in college, my friends played this game. I can't even remember the title of the game, but it's some game that basically translates to ball of stuff. And this little mouse, like, rolls around a ball, and he just starts picking up the stuff that he touches.
Okay.
And you start by picking up, like, lint and rubber bands and, like, acorns and stuff that's just on the floor, and dust. And then slowly but surely the ball grows, and you can pick up things like chairs and tables and soon houses and buildings. And that's sort of the way I think about what you're talking about with writing, is that you have to amass the words that aren't the best words, and you have to amass the experiences that aren't the best experiences. You have to put out some sentences that you don't love to be able to pick up chairs and houses and buildings and say something really cataclysmic about the truth of the human condition.
Yeah. And since some people may watch this on video, you might be able to see this.
Yes.
This is my writing journal, and this is the first draft. A lot of it I wrote down when I came home. But one of the things that you'll always see in my writing are a whole bunch of crossouts. Just so many crossouts. Lots of crossouts and writing over and writing above and writing on the side, because then I couldn't make it fit. And if I were to flip through this and show all the drafts and things that are crossed out and circle and move that over there, I mean, of course it's not perfect. If you don't write something bad, you will never write something good.
It's absolutely true. Yeah. If you hold yourself to that standard, you'll never write at all, because you'll be scared constantly to put pen to paper.
That's right.
And I think that's so hard. But the other thing is the bravery that it takes to put your work out there. Because we do. We say things that we perceive to be very controversial. I love the line about if our precious truths are torn and tattered. Just because I think it's really important for all of us to remember, especially right now when things are so politically contentious, that ideas are great and they fuel so many things. But ideas are impermanent by nature. Because something better is always going to come along. If you are working on an idea, you're going to have a better one. And part of being human is being able to let go of the bad idea. Part of being a good writer is being able to cross out the bad word and write a better one.
That's
and
right.
Being able to say to yourself, that doesn't mean that it doesn't invalidate the past experience. Like, I'm not shunning the me from 15 minutes ago who wrote a word that I no longer think is a great one. I'm not shunning me from 10 years ago who thought that this thesis was a great thesis statement. And now I'm like, I could have written a better one. That's just what growth looks like.
Right.
And it's okay to grow. And that process can be painful. But when we shed light on the painful, brave, messy process of growth, we give other people permission to go there with us.
Mm. That'll preach, Emmeline. I feel like that is maybe the number one thing I do as someone who teaches freshman writing. And these are freshman college students, and a lot of times they come to me so burned from past experiences and so scared. And I'm sure you're probably having some of those same experiences. They are paralyzed with the fear that they can't write. And I just have to teach them that we can have safe spaces to make mistakes.
Yeah, no, and mine will say it in class on the first day, because one of the questions that I ask is, what are you hoping to get from this class? And some of them will be like, I can't write. I'm a horrible writer. So I hope that when I get out of this, I'm a better writer. And and what I always tell them is, did you put words down on a page? Because that's what writing is.
Yeah.
Like, nobody said writing had to be perfect. If you put words down on a page, you're a writer. I didn't say you were a good writer, but can't write implies that you can't put words on a page.
Yeah.
And that's the point from which we start. But when we hold ourselves to that standard and when we allow the external pressure of that standard to affect who we are and what we put out in the world loses whatever wisdom we have to offer.
Yeah.
I love that you talk about putting art out. The refrain that my mentor in grad school had was submit, submit, submit.
Oh, yeah.
And I was 100% that kid that was like, I'm not going to submit. I'm not any good. I don't want to put out something that's going to... But he forced us to. And, you know, you get a lot of rejections, but the first acceptance changes your life.
Yeah. I had to learn how to do that. I'm still not very good at it because, I mean, nobody likes rejection, but I feel like I'm particularly sensitive to it, or maybe it just feels that way to me. So I've had to teach myself to do the work of submitting stuff, songs to contests, or asking for doing auditions, or asking for other kinds of things that I need. And it's great because eventually you do learn to get rejected. For me, auditioning for shows is a great process for that, because I've gotten a lot better at getting rejected for those things, but also just enjoying the process of doing the audition for what it is. Like, oh, I had a fun time doing that. I met some people, and also I learned to get rejected again, which is a really good thing to do. because you can get better at it, and then eventually you will get the acceptance, and those things are really fun. So yeah, that's a lesson I'm constantly learning too, but that has been like a discipline for me to submit work, put work out there, and just see what happens.
Yeah, because you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. Right. And I think that's a good thing for us to remember. Songwriters, it's a great thing that you share in this song. If love is what matters, then by loving, by leading with love, we never know who we're affecting.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's been a big thing. You know, nights, I think my cat is meowing now, and you can probably hear him through the door. on nights, when, I mean, we've probably both played shows where there's just like a tiny handful of people, and you never know when it's going to be that one person who just needs a little bit of joy and beauty in their life that night. And it matters. It all matters. Well, when you do it from love, I guess it matters.
Yeah, nothing else matters.
Yep.
It's so true. It's about how you lead. And I think whether you intended it to be a Christian song, whether you intended it to be an instructive song, whether you intended it to just be, you know, sort of a comfort to anybody who is mired in the pressure of climbing the ladder.
Yeah.
In whatever way, shape, or form that appears in their lives. I think you've written a song that reminds us to, like, be still and be grateful and be humble and be loving, because that's where the fruit is, you know?
Thank you.
That's beautiful. So when you had to record this, did you know exactly how you wanted it to sound?
Not exactly. Let's see. When we recorded this, we had been playing it live a little bit with my dad, who's multi-instrumentalist, and my husband Adam, who had been playing guitar with me live, and he would sometimes do some percussion. And we did one show with a friend of mine named Jenny, who sang some backup vocals. And so she had come up with some really lovely little background vocal lines that ended up making it onto the recording when we went into the studio, because she had come up with these lovely lines. And so she added that layer to it. On the record, it's me on guitar, and then I do both of the vocals. And my dad played a lot of other things. It's been a long time since we recorded this now, longer than I'd like to admit. So he played drums, and he played organ. That was the fun addition that I knew I wanted, but we hadn't necessarily gotten to practice with the organ sounds as much live before we went into the studio. And so he really added some great, great organ sounds that went in there. And I believe that Adam added some additional guitar, and I don't remember who played bass. It could have been either one of them. They were kind of taking turns at the time. It was one that was fairly simple to do. So it was really just an extension of our live sound, which is this acoustic folk thing with these kind of occasional touches of organ or other keyboard sounds. But then, you know, with the bass and drums added. So it's really that classic folk rock scenario where you start with folk and then you layer on the rock with the instrumentation. So it's pretty much how we did that whole record, man. For that album, we booked like 3 full studio days, and we just like barreled in and recorded everything as fast as we could. And then I had like a mess of files to deal with to clean the tracks and mix them. So I did a lot of editing and mixing in the next year or so. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that approach where you have to go so fast in the studio that you end up with all these tracks that you end up having to do stuff with. So at this point, it's a little bit of a mess, but you know, I don't think I had to clean those takes very much. I think that we pretty much got it the way we wanted it with just a few pass-throughs, and it was what we wanted because it was pretty simple. It's that folk rock foundation, really, for what I like to play.
So I hear you saying that everybody went into the studio and led with love.
That's what we did. That's right.
That's so beautiful. I can't wait for our audience to hear the recorded version. Thank you so much, friend, for coming on tonight and for sharing
Thank
with me
you.
All of these wonderful nerdy songwriting things, and for sharing with our listeners all of this stuff. I think it's such a beautiful glimpse when not only a songwriter, but someone who teaches songwriting sort of breaks down the process, yeah. Just because I think it demystifies some of it in a way that empowers people to...
That's what I want. Yeah.
Explore a little bit. That's beautiful.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Yeah.
No, absolutely. If people are listening and they're thinking, oh my gosh, Christine sounds amazing, where can I hear the rest of her beautiful album, The Book of the World, where's the best place for them to find you?
Well, you can find links to all the things you might want to buy at christinehand.com. It's Christine with a C and hand like your hand. But you can also listen to the whole album on Spotify, iTunes, anywhere else you like to get your music. I would enjoy seeing my Spotify listens grow, so I'm just going to say go to Spotify.
I love it. Oh, so if you're listening on the radio, that's Christine Hand, and it's christinehand.com. And if you're listening on a podcast, you have a very easy job. You just scroll up and click, and it will be linked below. You can also hear Nothing Else Matters on the Journey of a Song Spotify playlist. So you can hear all of the songs from our back episodes, and you can hear Christine with a bunch of other beautiful songwriters who... she's had the opportunity to play some shows with. And then you should add all of Christine's songs to your Spotify playlists so that all of the listens grow.
Yes. Thank you so much, Emmeline. This has been a real pleasure. And gosh, it almost feels indulgent to just sit here and talk about a single song like this. What a joy.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, selfishly, right? That's why I started this. But I am so grateful for people like you who are kind enough to come on and give of your time and give of your talent to share with me and to share with our listeners, you know, what it is to write something that means a lot to you.
Yeah.
The last thing we have to do is play the fully produced version of Nothing Else Matters. Would you like to introduce your song?
Sure. This is Nothing Else Matters by Christine Hand.
Could write a thousand songs, shimmering with angel tongues, golden voices all night long, and only half clatter. 'Cause if I don't have love, what does it matter? Nothing else matters. Perfect life, daughter, sister, mother, wife. Spend my years in daily strife, climbing the ladder. But if I don't have love, what does it matter? Nothing else matters.
Much for joining me for this week's episode of Journey of a Song, featuring the talented Christine Hand and her beautiful song, Nothing Else Matters. To learn more about Christine or to follow her musical journey, visit her official website, christinehand.com. That's christinehand.com. For behind-the-scenes glimpses and more about Journey of a Song, follow me on Instagram at emmelinemusic. That's at E-M-M-E-L-I-N-E music. Don't forget to check out my other show, Journey of an Artist, Sundays at 5 p.m. Central Standard Time on Deep Ellum Radio. Journey of a Song airs Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time on Deep Ellum Radio, and each episode is available as a podcast the very next day. Discover new music and hear fascinating stories with me, Emmeline, every Thursday night on Deep Ellum Radio. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to tune in next week. This is only the beginning, and I don't want you to miss a single minute of these inspiring conversations. If a picture is worth a thousand words, a song is worth a thousand stories. Deep Ellum Radio, with all of its fantastic programming, including Journey of a Song, Journey of an Artist, and the upcoming Veronica Young Show, is powered by the Deep Ellum Foundation.